You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, KTAH, Radio Tacoma, and I'm very, very happy to welcome Abby Murray today, who is the current Poet Laureate of City of Tacoma, Washington. And yeah. We are just delighted to have you with time on your hands to be able to read some poetry to us and tell us about your Poet Laureate life, if you wish.
This poem is, I think, about 2 weeks old. I write a poem every week by Friday at midnight. And I wrote this after hearing the Queen's address, after which so many people were so viscerally just relieved, calmed. And it reminded me of my mother. This is The Queen Speaks. And we are all 9 years old again, about to jump from our rooftops with pocket knives clenched in our teeth. Her platform is the porch swept clean, her robe a rug to be shaken out. When she calls one of us inside, the rest instinctively remember what doorways await our return. Our own mothers presiding over fate with the patience of generals, capable of slapping truth from a tulip or shaping bullets from the lead of war and politics and plagues. The Queen speaks, and street lamps in our global neighborhood illuminate the prayer we do not want but need to hear. It is time to come home, set the table, and survive together. When we run toward her voice, we try not to look wild or hungrier than we really are, calling over our shoulders to our grief, swearing we'll come back stronger.
Very, very fine. Ode to a mother. And from the very motherly Queen's talk that I think came across as almost an old psychic feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No dogma in her voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, good. Starting with mother, have you got any other parental pieces or family poems there?
I had a poem recently in Journal of American Poetry, and I'm starting to write about my mother more. I grew up with five sisters and a single mother, and I guess that actually says a lot. No brothers, lots of estrogen, mm-hmm. And a strong belief in the matriarch. So three of us are adopted, and three were my mother's biological children. It was a bit of a Brady Bunch kind of mashup. I love my sisters, but I've always felt very different. My sisters were all, growing up, they struck me as very feminine. Whatever I was, it was not falling into line with what the idea of feminine behavior and body type was looking like. So I had very short hair. I had a bowl cut for a long time because I kept wrecking my hair, getting stuff stuck in it, burning it off. And my sisters had long hair. So this poem is called The Story of My Hair. It was written after I spent some time thinking about why my mom may have kept my hair so short. So this is the story of my hair. I'm seven, and my hair is a shallow brown bowl where my mother keeps my skull. My sisters wear their hair like veils, clean and straight, sometimes drawing them up like long curtains or ironing them flat. But my mother keeps my hair shorn to my temples. I wouldn't know how to care for long hair, she says, and she isn't wrong. I burn what length I do have down to the root on a Christmas candle. I snip a clump of tree sap from my scalp in the yard. My hair makes people call me boy and buddy and champ. At JCPenney, a woman tells my mom she's lucky, six children, but hey, at least one son. I don't mind until I do. I want to be Medusa when I'm older, turn men with too much courage into stone. I want them to seize open-mouthed so I can poke their dull pebble teeth. I squat in the yard and bitch to the squirrels about survival. I pretend I am Samson and heave rocks into the grass, saving everyone but myself. In the nativity play, my sisters are cast as angels or Mary, and I am the serpent who spits on the word of God, who is booed off the stage by a choir of children coached to despise the yellow scales my mother stitched onto black spandex for my costume. Once the boys start coming for my sisters, they do not stop. They have hands like combs. My scalp is scrubbed raw in the kitchen. Not once do I question the hand that cranks the scissors. Not once am I grateful for my sunburned neck, my broad shoulders. Strength is a braid my mother twists for me with hair she takes away. I wear it blindly, this whip of power, coiled where I can't find it, and boys do not want what they cannot see.
Ah, you are a transformational being in that poem. Your childhood took many forms, metamorphosis, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And your hair definitely played a part. Were you rascally? Did you go off and do things on your own that were risky?
Yes. I was very adventurous. I loved being outside. I loved climbing. I remember, you know, I have a niece now who is 13, and she is so poised compared to what I was like when I was 13. I was still climbing trees. I loved tree forts. I loved the idea of running away. My Side of the Mountain, Hatchet, Island of Blue Dolphins, these were the books that I just ate up. I loved adventuring and being on my own. And that may have been partly because I was in such a crowded house growing up that being alone was very appealing to me. I had one best friend. I didn't do like the big groups and lots of friends. And if you had left me to my own devices, I would have lived in a tree. So.
But you found that probably very informing as you grew up. Today, children, do you think because of their digital concentration that they play act or transform or work on different sort of character studies as much now?
I don't know. I think just as it was when I was young and when my mother's generation was young, it depends on the person. My daughter is 6. I have one child and she is constantly playing. She's constantly in another world. She's always changing. She's a spy. No, she's a pirate fairy. No, she's a cheetah. No, now she's a jaguar unicorn. And, you know, and is constantly telling me, like explaining to me, the grown-up, obviously the more dense of the two of us, you know, what she is and where she's from and what her powers are. That's very important. And yet, you know, especially since quarantine has begun, we have to rely on screens. She is doing schoolwork on school websites, Schoology, Prodigy, Clever, Freckle. There's so many. And like, so she's doing all these different projects on screens and I want her to do well on those. But I also want her to be outside drawing on trees with chalk. And I want her to be a jaguar unicorn with powers. And it just depends, I think, on the child. Some of them gravitate more toward one or the other, I think.
With so much concentration, perhaps trying to get the diligence instilled, you know, for the kind of learning that's going to come, I wonder if there'll be as much outward going because of this. How much a teacher who is looking at many pictures now might be able to allow all sorts of behaviors at once.
Yeah.
You have some poems about your daughter?
I do, yes. I write about her often. I've already written my poem for this week, so I could share that one.
I haven't come to Friday yet, so is it edited?
It is done, but I feel like there is a stage in writing poetry where I feel comfortable with a draft, and I feel comfortable with it.
Very well, read that one. That's good.
Yeah, I wrote this on Earth Day. My daughter and I went for a walk, and she is fascinated with oppression right now. She's very interested. You know, Martin Luther King Day was very, I think it was shocking to her to know that people have been so blatantly and explicitly oppressed and harmed, because it goes against everything she's been taught, which is to be kind. So that was very fascinating. And Earth Day, we were talking about the earth and taking care of the earth. And she asked me on our walk, she was like, were our ancestors Indians or murderers? We hadn't been talking about anything in particular before that, other than just walking on this path that we go to like every day. We walk on this path. It's a beautiful trail. And I said, murderers. We kept talking about that. So this is the poem that came from that. And it is called Identity Lessons. We are wearing the shadow of an old cedar. When my daughter asks if our ancestors were Indians or the ones who murdered them. Murderers, I say, because it is true. Fight me. We are quiet together. We walk slow. While she is young, my daughter can only give birth to questions, which run without end once spoken, like water beneath a glacier or roots under a city, carving the earth into wedges of bread that feed without judgment. Today, I am glad to know questions, at least, cannot be killed. We stop on our walk to notice how the same cedar that cools us snaps the heavy slabs of our sidewalk like crackers, as if to remind us how fragile we are.
Oh, that's a brilliant opening too, foreshadowing the darkness clad in the shadow of the cedar. Yeah, very fine poem that is. Yes, with the return to the importance of the cedar tree, which has so much resonance of Indian crafts and lore and so forth.
Yeah. Cedars were everywhere where I grew up. I mean, they're everywhere here too, but I used to love them, peeling strips of cedar off, and we would draw pictures on them. And I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The texture of cedar is amazing. Photographers are enamored of it. Did you read that to your daughter, and did she have a reaction to it?
I haven't read it to her yet, no. When I answered her question, I said, you know, murderers, but then we talked about it later that night because I think I needed to collect my thoughts, because she asked me a question that had a multiple choice answer. She said, is it this or this? And so when a child asks you that, they don't want to hear you speak about the in-between. They want you to answer their question. So I gave her an answer, but I needed to talk about that later. And we did talk about that a little bit later. And she's just very, you know, she's in kindergarten. And I think the learning stage really in kindergarten is so much is based on deciding who's the villain, who's the good guy. And my husband told her the other night, he was like, everyone thinks they're the good guy. And that kind of blew her mind too. And so we have a lot of conversations because of the nature of my husband's work. We talk about mortality often. We talk about war. We talk about military purpose. And Tom and I disagree on that in different ways. Tom and I are very similar, but we met because we were so different. He was an ROTC and I was a protester. So we've never seen completely eye to eye on military, but I don't find that necessary in order to love someone. So
antagonism that charges argument isn't a bad thing with husband and wife.
Agreed.
And it's not a bad thing, I think, nowadays for children to hear arguments at work. The hiding of children away and protecting them from such things, I think, is kind of peculiar. Keeping them in the dark or in the, you know, not allowing them to get glimpses, because at 6 years old, you're still getting glimpses, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, imagine their surprise when they are in high school and realize the world is a mess. I think that would be very jarring to learn that as a teenager when your hormones aren't even in check. terrifying.
Confusions inside and out, right? Yeah. Many, many mixed up things. How to sort it out. So are you dealing with some of the issues then of our adjusting these days to in the way you present things to audiences, say, about the adjustments that we might have to make or the adjustments we are presently in the making of?
Yeah, this is a big adjustment for me in that I don't normally rely on technology, digital technology, this much, this often. If given a choice, I see screens as work. They're a workplace for me. And so my natural inclination is to get away from them. So to put them down at the end of the day. And what we're going through right now has made it so screens are even more present, if that was even possible. You know, when I teach, it's important for me to be there with my students. It means a great deal to me to stand with my students, to sit beside them, to write with them when we're writing. And to have that taken away is quite difficult. So it has been a challenge for me. I started a YouTube channel for Grit City Poet Laureate, and I'm doing workshops, flash workshops every Friday. And that's fun, but it's been a learning curve for me. I don't consider myself very tech savvy. So it's just a challenge.
The spatial aspect of poetry, you remember your TED Talks, you're there on a stage, you've got an audience. Mm-hmm. The way the voice resonates in a room with other people is a very different thing from the kind of metallic recording that you get from a screen.
Yeah.
On a machine. We're mm-hmm. we're becoming more mechanical and flatter.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely flatter. I mean, I see you more or less two-dimensionally, even though I can imagine three dimensions, and you see that I've got space behind me. But all you hear is this kind of tinny resonance that I express. And your voice is probably much more resonant in the open space. So we're restricted. We're losing something here.
Well, and we lose the ability to remember what it's like to be in our bodies. When you are in a classroom, you're in the library with me doing a workshop. You are in there. Your whole person is in there. It's not just your shoulders up that's in this workshop. You are in a community workshop with other community members, and you are present in your body. You know what your body is doing the whole time. You know how it feels to bend over the table and write. You know how it feels to look up and listen to a poem. And we're losing some of that here.
It's a great loss in some respects for the poetic performance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go to, did you go to some of the Tacoma events like the colloquy over the years?
I did, yeah. I performed at one of them a couple of months ago. I want to say it was at the end of 2019 that I got to perform at the colloquy, which was very cool.
Well, read another one, any variety you wish, to another direction if you want.
Okay, well, I have a poem that it's very short from last week that I was hearing a lot of politicians and public speakers just in general speak about the risk of reopening businesses. They kept using this word only in front of numbers of people. Only the elderly, only the immunocompromised, only this group, only Black communities. And it was the only that was really bothering me was putting only in front of people who you were dismissing to die. And I've heard this too with military in talking about, well, it's only soldiers. And, you know, they knew what they were getting into when they signed up. And it's this only that really pisses me off. And so I wanted to write about the dead, and I wanted to write about how the dead maybe long for the living, I guess, or have more respect for the living. And so this is what the dead do. All night, the dead must wait for morning in America, unable to smoke or even wring their hands, as they long to be with the living more than we do. And I have that written as two words per line, and it kind of establishes a very punctuated rhythm down the page, which is intentional.
Yeah, very poignant from the point of view of one who has died. The death that we are dealing with now, I came across thoughts of T.S. Eliot, Wasteland. April is the cruelest month, you know. And that line where he saw the people marching, or their heads down, bowed, walking across the bridge. He could not have conceived that there were so many. And they're like the dead from the war, from the past, marching, never ending, across the bridge. I think images like that will come to mind as we continue on. This is not over yet.
No.
And we know so little from those who have experienced the real trauma of having endured the pain, the coughing, and the isolation from family during this time. What must be like?
Yes.
To be convalescing without the ability to have your family help.
Yeah. To not be able to say goodbye.
To not be able to say goodbye. Yes, the dying. You can't get in to see your husband. He's in ICU. Unfortunately, I don't think he's going to make it, but we can't let you in.
Yeah. And so I feel like the people who, you know, this is a burden that they're going to carry for the rest of their lives, the survivors, and they're still learning how to wrap up that burden in order to carry it for the next, you know, years, decades that they'll have it.
Yes, we'll be carrying more than the immunity microbes, that's for sure, in our bodies. We'll be carrying a great deal of psychic weight that we can't really dissolve. We can't really break through.
Yeah.
This is new.
Yeah.
Well, read us another one. If you want to uplift us, that wouldn't be bad too.
Oh, you know what? I should read this because it's the season of mason bees, and we keep mason bees in our backyard. We rent them every year. So I have a poem for a mason bee, and this is more, well, it's an appreciation of the mason bee, which, you know, if you're not familiar with mason bees, they're not as beautiful as honeybees. They're black. They kind of look like big flies, and they don't sting, and they, I forget what the percentage is, how much more they pollinate than honeybees, but it's ridiculously high. Like, they pollinate much more. And so I very much saw the hard work, the laborer in the mason bee, but I think my feminism is also on display here. This is poem for a mason bee. This one's for you, a queen on my back stoop in May. Easy to identify when a male drones past because she is larger, hairier, her jaw heavier, ideal for carrying mud to shut up fractures in her home. I like the way she flies to my bare shoulder, but still won't rest. Has to turn circles on my skin as if to say, I might be beautiful if only she had the time and will to repair me. But there's lavender to navigate and clay to carry, and I am more broken than she has daylight to spend. I envy the way she speaks above words, her dull face set like flint beneath stumpy antennae. She prefers solitude to life in the hive and wears a black suit nowhere near as cute as her cousin's yellow sweater. I applaud her plainness and the way she survives without venom or honey, because I too have wanted to dress myself in disregard and refuse to fix what isn't mine. I too have dreamt of crawling face first into an apple blossom and knowing I am sovereign in that one room, knowing the hum I hear there is the anthem of me. But mostly I cooperate and produce and revise in exchange for gratitude. I earn my pleasure so I can sacrifice it fairly. What I mean to say is I'd like to propose a toast with this garden hose, a sip of warm water in her honor, this mason bee. May she thrive disinterested in my salute. May she pollinate with more skill than her charmed relatives and never find value in my thank you.
What a beautiful beast and very beautiful poem.
Thanks.
Very, very fine images there. Yeah, that is very spring-like and hopeful. The ongoing life of the many.
Yes.
The one in the many. Yes. Great creature. And you keep those in a hive?
They come in, there's a wooden block and it has drilled holes all the way through it.
Oh.
And they, when they lay eggs, they shut up the hole with mud or clay. So we keep a bowl of clay in the backyard, and that's how they leave it. And then we turn in the eggs.
I had seen some of those at Costco, I think. Is that where you can purchase them?
We got ours from a farmer's market in Tacoma.
Well, lovely. Have you got a couple of poems that you would like to just read in succession? Enjoy just delivering those as a performance?
Sure, I can do that. You know, we were talking earlier about the military, and I don't know if I had told you this, that my book came out in September 2019, Hail and Farewell.
Who published that?
Perugia Press. It won their poetry prize for 2019, and they publish women's first or second books.
Congratulations.
Thank you. They're a wonderful press. I'm really glad that they chose my work.
Yes.
But I have a lot of poems in here that are looking at that difference, really, between me and the military community. So I could share some of those. I'm not a soldier. I've never been to war. I am not in the military. So I don't claim to write through that perspective. But being married to someone who is in the military and being a woman has given me a somewhat unique perspective of the strange, unwritten rules of etiquette in military communities. And so I write often about military wife etiquette, I guess. And this is from the book, Hail and Farewell. And this is called The War Trampled Us. And I wrote this much later after, but this is when I was in Alaska. Tom's first assignment was at Fort Richardson in Alaska. The war tramples us. Upstairs, my neighbor reads about carbon monoxide. We communicate without language at the shared mailbox where we wait for letters shipped in crates from Iraq. When I say nothing to her, she says nothing back. The floorboards groan when she rocks her two boys into a deep sleep, an ocean of night. She floats to the garage, curls up on the back seat of her Jeep, and tracks the brown moths crawling across fluorescent lights. They drop like folded paper. Later, a man in fire gear delivers her to my porch. He says we should evacuate. She apologizes, her voice the hollow boom of babies carried off in an ambulance. What can I do? I lean against the doorframe, smelling poison. That was particularly terrifying. And this poem as well has to do with when Tom was stationed in Alaska. I haven't been back in several years, so I'm not sure if these two particular people are still there. This is Skin Lady. The Skin Lady sells otter, moose, bear, and deer hides on the corner of Northern Lights Boulevard and Seward Highway, beginning in September all the way through first thaw. As a community, we have more sympathy for her than the man who sells whale baleen on the same corner during summer, who smiles into our open car windows and waves in his bare hands enormous bristle-edged fronds. The Skin Lady, whose face I've never seen, whose face is the memory of a hood cinched around a scarf-drawn mouth, keeps her hands layered in as many mittens as she can find in gutters or lost in parking lots, whose hands, I imagine, are carved from wood. I have never seen her with her arms at her sides. They sway above her head, furs hanging down and filling with wind, as if to call their spirits back. She keeps extra skins in a pile by her boots, heaped on the snow and salt. I have never seen her set up shop or roll the furs back up at night, and I've never seen a customer. In April, she disappears, and Anchorage is at its ugliest. All of us so sick of slush, we barely remember a woman selling skins on the corner so recently. A woman we only guess is female because we can't make out the shape of her body. And the way she returns each year makes us feel terrible about some crime we know we've committed.
Very hard-hitting, yes. Wonderful poems, Abby. You have been listening to Abby Murray, the current poet laureate of Tacoma, giving us some wonderful samples, great variety of really sensitive, poignant, but very visceral poetry too, that I hope many of you can remember and enjoy listening to with the repeated listenings. Thank you so much, Abby.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma. I'm your host, David Gilmore.